This is Oral History Interview 1 with Phil Price, conducted by Steve Maxner. It's the 22nd of July, 1999 at 9:20 a.m. Mr. Price, if you would, just give us your full name and your dates of service in the Army and dates of service in Vietnam, please.
Okay. My name is Philip C. Price, C for Clifton. I went in the Army in just before Thanksgiving, November 1967. I was released in about the 12th, 13th of May, 1970. I was in Vietnam. My DROS date was May 2nd, but we had 2 weeks in Panama prior to getting in country. So I actually got in country about May 15th, something like that. I was wounded on the 4th of September. Spent one night in a MASH unit, one night on the runway in Cameron Bay. I was flown to Tokyo for operation. One night on the runway there. Then about 9 days, they always kept you on the runway to make sure you were stable. And then medevaced home. I got back to Fort Sill. They sent me by way of California, Travis Air Force Base there, and then one of the many hospital bases in San Antonio, and then back to Fort Sill. I got there about the 20th of September. I made first lieutenant flying back from Tokyo. So that's my service dates.
Okay, would you give us a description of your basic training and whatever pertinent information that you think is relevant to preparing you for Vietnam and the kinds of training you received, weapons training, things like that, and whether or not you thought the training was appropriate to your experiences in Vietnam?
I don't think you really realize you're going to be going until you actually see Vietnam. Even the training in jungle school was not as realistic. I flunked one of my leadership courses because I had my men charge when mortars were going off, but actually I knew they were just dynamite or C4 going off in heavily sandbagged pits, so it was not realistic, even though the surroundings and the terrain were very much. Basically, I think the training was good, but basic, you learn how to be a soldier. Not a whole lot about your much more advanced than that. AIT, we learned more, but again, most of the really good training as far as map reading and how to move artillery around and that sort of thing came during OCS. All of it was just kind of to get you there and get you ready. I can't say that I was totally ready mentally or physically. I was pretty much in shape. I went from 217 when I enlisted to 145 while I was in OCS. I received two changes of clothes on the Army. Immediately when I got out, I had 2 weeks off. I spent eating mother's food, and I had to buy my own uniforms this time because the old ones didn't fit, because I was going to be a TAC officer. A TAC officer is like a drill instructor over officer candidates, and you run just like they run, so I knew I'd be in shape, but I was not as in shape as I was when I was a candidate. I was trainee of the cycle when I graduated from basic training. Just no particular reason. I didn't know there was a competition. I was an honor graduate out of OCS. Again, I didn't know there was a competition. I had tried every honorable way to avoid the service. I was 20, well, in 77, I'd be 24 years old. 67, I would have been 23. And I didn't really think we were trying to win the war, and that opinion never did really change. I tried, like I say, every honorable way. When I first was drafted, my car was in Seattle. I'd been visiting a crew that worked for me on the East Coast, and I was in Kalamazoo, actually. And Mother called and said, "Phil, this looked important," so I opened it, and you're supposed to report for a physical in the morning. She went down and flunked the physical, and I got back in as fast as I could. I was again received a draft notice, and my dad had a convulsion and was assumed dead, and I got another 30-day. I moved my draft board. I'm not sure exactly which order these happened. I moved my draft board from Amarillo to Lubbock and got another 30-day extension. I was trying to get in into the Air Force. I wanted to fly, and found out I couldn't because my eyes weren't good enough. I had to have 20/20. But they said my hearing's fine, so I could be on the ground. Received another draft notice and had no way of avoiding it. Went in and they had I had a kidney infection, which I didn't know. And they gave it me another 30 days, and I realized my luck was about to run out. So, being the brave, patriotic American I am, I volunteered. But I wanted to be an officer. And the recruiter told me that I could put down 5 different branches of the service. Of course, I put down Signal Corps and, you know, a lot of things like that. And then he reminded me that one of the 5 OCS choices that I had to make had to be a combat branch. And he said, go ahead and put infantry down, which I did. There is no Signal Corps OCS. There, you know, this was all a farce. I guess it was artillery and infantry were about the only 2 OCSs that existed, but he allowed me to put these other branches down. Let me say, too, that having gone and served and been in the infantry, I have a great deal of pride in it now, but at the time was not too pleased about it. If you're an honor graduate from OCS, I finished 4th in my class, you get a branch transfer to the branch of your choice, and I wanted civil affairs, and I was going to get it, and then get an RA commission, which would be the same as a West Point graduate has, and would have been a very good career move if I'd wanted to stay. I had to extend for a year, and I was asking the major how long it would be. This is the day I was commissioned, and I was signing my papers to extend for a year, and he said, well, it'll take about 18 months for it to go through. You'll be back from Vietnam. We didn't train you to be a platoon leader for nothing. So I turned down the RA commission and the extension. Later, when I got to Vietnam, I asked for civil affairs again, and the clerk typed in officer desires CA work, got to my unit, and the clerk there said, sir, you're the first son of a bitch who's ever volunteered for CA. You're assigned to Captain C.A. Strable. And I said, does Captain Strable do a lot of civil affairs? And the clerk said, no, sir, CA stands for combat assault. So that's how I got my job. First, you ask how well prepared I was. The first M16 I saw was in Vietnam. I qualified. I thought I qualified as expert because I was using a pencil, but it seemed like I got sharpshooter. I did qualify expert on an M14, and I had ridden in an armored personnel carrier once, and they gave me a unit of them when I got to Vietnam, and I got to learn how to manage those.
Okay, why don't you describe your initial experiences in country. Actually, just take a step back quickly, if you would. You mentioned earlier that you had spent some time in Panama, en route to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. What was that for? Was that for any kind of particular training?
Or it was jungle school.
It was jungle school.
Yeah, you had
to describe that.
It was far more realistic. I thought at that time, normally you had a year before you went in country, and I had expected to have a year, but they were running out of second lieutenants, or lieutenants. And I got my orders in about 6 months. And when I got to Charleston or Charlotte, I guess it was Charleston, I was waiting on taking my plane to Panama. And I looked down and a pair of jump boots came up in Class A uniform. And I looked up and it was one of my buddies from OCS, and Paulus was going too. We flew to Panama City, and then they trucked us out to Fort Sherman. And there we learned rappelling, we learned how to live in the jungle, how to eat everything except sea rations. We ate sauce, cotamundis, snakes. But, you know, if you just wrap it around a stick and cook it long enough, it all tastes alike. But that counted as time in country, so I wasn't upset about that. One of the captains who was with us taking it told me when I get there I need to buy a Seiko or Seiko. I never knew how to pronounce that watch, which I did for $25 when I got, and it was a good one. It ran for years and years. Fort Sherman, the hardest thing was an escape and evasion. It was only about 15 miles, and they let us off. And of course, they had ambushes set up along the roads. They did track with dogs, and they used patrol boats on the rivers. And the 5 of us decided to take the river route, and it was the Chagres River. And only 2 of us made it. The other 3, one was physically, just had the runs and what have you, and couldn't keep up. The other 2 just didn't push as hard. Paulus and I, this Bob Paulus, same guy I had seen it in Charleston, he was in front of me at one time. We were crawling along the roots of mangrove trees that grew on the river. And, you know, they're up, you know, everywhere from 2 or 3 to 15 feet, I guess, above the water. And he disappeared. And then he turned on his light, and he was underwater. And I grabbed him and pulled him up, but he was stuck in the mud. And but we continued down, and we had many times the patrol boats would come by with signals, and when that happened, we would drop under the water, and they would try to fake you out, saying they saw you and come on out and all that. But I would imagine it, that was probably the most realistic. We had like 3 days to get there and get to get through escape and evasion, and get to California. We got through about 5:30 in the morning. They'd let us off the night before, or the afternoon before. And if you got caught, you were sent to a prisoner of war camp, and I did not want to do that. So we got there, and we had a radio code that we worked with a patrol boat, or a small boat, that took us across the river. We had swam it once during training, but I did not want to swim it, especially at night. And but we got in, and Paulus and I grabbed a wooden bench, put it into the showers, and just sat there naked, and slowly got naked in the hot water because we were dead tired. I don't think we slept. We went downstairs, had a small officers club there, and had breakfast. I went on to I told Paulus I was going to stop by and see Vicky because I could spend 2 nights in Amarillo. He said that he couldn't, that he said he'd said his goodbyes, and I didn't realize a lot of the turmoil he was going through. But he went on to California. I stopped in Amarillo. On the way to the airport, I know I was in my Class A's khakis, and a carload of teenagers passed and laughed at me, which kind of hurt. But when I got there, our flight was supposed to leave at 10, and it was about 9:50, and there was the longest line. It was probably 2 or 3 blocks long, as long as it would stretch. And I was thinking, well, heck, I'm going to get to spend the night here. And Paulus was about third in line, and he leaned out and said, "Hey, Price, I saved you a place." And that was the only time they didn't mind you cutting in line in the Army. And so he and I and a guy, one of our OCS classmates who did get Signal Corps, flew over together. I don't know that we knew any of the other folks there, but it was nice to know that we weren't the only ones going early. But we flew to Hawaii, landed in the middle of the night, and they let us off the plane for a little while. And the airport was deserted. It was kind of surreal because they did have a little band that played Hawaiian tunes, and I wasn't going to Hawaii. We landed again in Guam and had breakfast there, and then loaded back up and flew to Vietnam. The first time when I saw it, the Signal Corps guy told me, you know, "Hey, Price, I can see this." And I looked out and I saw the mountains, and they were dark and foreboding. It was eerie. It was almost an out-of-body experience. Signal Corps guy, I don't know his name. I spent 6 months with him, though. But he asked Paulus and I if we really thought we could kill a guy. And I thought it was kind of strange that for 10 months I'd been trained to kill people with everything from knives to grenades to artillery. And I told him I thought I could. And Paulus said he'd have to think about it. He was the first one of our company to get killed. But I did research recently, and he was shot in the head in an ambush. And I actually got a hold of, through email, the man who pulled him out, and went back and took charge of his platoon. It was a sergeant. He's now a high school principal. And he described what they had found the day before and the fight, and that Bob was alive when he put him on the chopper, but he had died earlier. But he was the first of our company to get killed. A couple of our TAC officers we knew were already dead because they were naturally 6 months in front of us. So it was kind of my first impression. I know it was weird. We landed at Benoit and walked into, and I didn't realize, I didn't know where Benoit was. I didn't know we were in Saigon or virtually there. And I walked into, it wasn't a tent, it was just a metal roof, and had no sides, and had benches for us to wait for our names to be called. And here we all were fresh scrubbed and fresh faced. And I looked over in the corner, and there was an old sergeant sitting there, and he was dirty, and he had his rifle and ammo and grenades and everything. And it was surreal because of all the safety precautions and training, we never would carry that. But he was just leaning up against the corner, asleep, waiting for his, he was just catching a hop somewhere.
And that was in May 1969?
May, uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
Now, and what unit were you assigned to initially?
I was only assigned to one unit, 2nd Platoon, A Company, 2nd of the 8th Infantry, 4th Infantry Division. We were a mechanized unit. Battalion headquarters was at Camp Inari, which is Pleiku. I went to, that may have been division headquarters too. I spent one night, I spent two or three nights there processing in. We got our uniforms in Benoit, and Paulus and I went together to get them. And it was kind of eerie because here they were, jungle fatigues, jungle boots and everything. And I don't know if we bought or had shoestrings that we put our dog tags on. And I had made sure I had a watch that didn't glow in the dark and didn't tick. It was one of the first electric watches. And then I got an armored personnel carrier you could hear from Pleiku to Kontoon, so it didn't really matter much.
That was an M113 armored personnel?
I guess. I don't know. That's what people have told me that they were. But see, they just dropped me off and said, this is your platoon. And I remember watching the Jeep head back toward Pleiku, and I felt like a calf watching its mama being led back to the barn. But we got our weapons when we got to Camp Inari, and we got a briefing by I don't know which colonel. It wasn't the colonel that was mine, so he must have been over my colonel. But it was a huge map, and they brought the young officers in. I don't think they did it to the enlisted, but they told them, you know, you're going to be fighting the 69th. Infantry division or battalion, whatever it was, it really didn't matter. It didn't soak in. But they told us who we were fighting, where they were, and where we would be scattered, or what our mission was, basically.
What other aspects of an in-country briefing did they give you in terms of trying to prepare you for the culture of the Vietnamese, interacting with people, you know, staying away from brothels and things of that nature?
They gave us a couple of books. I still haven't read them. I guess if you were going to stay in camp, I didn't spend any time in camp except during processing in, and I went back, I guess, twice as pay officer. And ironically, I was in camp three times and saw the same movie all three times. But at least it had white women in it. But they did very little that I can recall. I've got a couple of books I'll show you, and it gives the history of Southeast Asia, and I didn't really care, and most of the people I was with didn't care. We wanted to know how many days we had left, and every day I could tell you how many days I'd been there and how many days I had left.
How long a tour were you on? Was it
365. Or 364 and a wake up. And as soon as you get there, you start seeing signs that are short. When you'd go into a stall in the John, and there'd be a pair of boots with a helmet on top of it, and the guy, and underneath it says, "I'm so short I walked in without opening the door." Mm-hmm. And because that was the term, being short meant that you had, you know, very few days to go.
And that meant 365 days in combat.
In country.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, some officers, I know the battalion, brigade, and higher, some of them were on a 6-month combat rotation. Was that the case with lieutenants in your unit?
Or, no. No.
Was that the case with the battalion brigade officers?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
The only time mine changed while I was there, and I don't know why they changed, and we got a Colonel Zapp. Fortunately, he liked me. And I don't want to paint it that I was a bad soldier, but at that time, we had the general feeling that we weren't really trying to win the war, and so what our mission was to try not to die.
Now, was that a sentiment held at all levels of command that you were aware of, in terms of your level, company, battalion, brigade?
They were more gung-ho the further removed from the fighting. I was chewed out one time. We were chasing them, and if you can see the map, you can see those are, what are they, 20 meters, I think, for each line, something like that. So that's pretty steep mountains. Mm-hmm. And I had a chopper telling me to take a 5-degree turn to the right. And I told him that I couldn't make a fucking 5-degree turn to the right. And another, I think my colonel, wanted to know if I knew who in the hell I was talking to. And I said, no, I don't, but I know where in the hell he is, and I know where in the hell I am, and I know there's a fucking cliff 5 degrees to my right. And they let me go. I was not really insubordinate, but it was, I'm sure it's grown over the years. But they would be more gung-ho. I was told one night I was going to be attacked by 160, a reinforced company with 160 men with mortars, and I had 22 guys, but I had 12 machine guns, and I knew where they would come from or where I thought they would. And before I let my guys eat, we crawled out and put out new trip flares, and we got grazing fire with our guns. And I'd go in. There are a lot of other things I did, but we were ready. And we ate our sea rations as it got dark. And I had just finished my sea ration, and as I set it down beside me, the click of it, I can remember it, the click of it hitting the armored personnel carrier was the same as the click that a trip flare has, because they click first and they shoot up in the air as they go off. And I heard it, and we were firing before it really was fully off, and because they were crawling in on us. And we chased them away, pulled artillery in on them. We had artillery coming from a fire base and one coming from Artillery Hill. And we also had our mortar. And it was later when Captain Strabel got down, was chewed out for not chasing them. And I thought, well, if there are 160 of them and 22 of me, what if I catch them? And so at that particular time, I had two Kit Carson scouts, which we did use to track and what have you. If they found anything that was really serious, the one that we used the most, his name was Choke. They were ex North Vietnamese that had gone over. And they knew if they were captured, it was pretty bad for them, where they might just shoot us, but it would be bad for them. And Choke always got malaria every time we got close to a fight, so I knew if it was serious, if he was laying in his bed shivering. Not his bed. We didn't have beds. We had air mattresses we blew up.
Mm-hmm. What were the soldiers like in your platoon? How well trained were they? Your NCOs, were they competent? Did you have any problems? Were they all squared away?
When I took over my platoon, I met two lieutenants who had the platoon I told you yesterday. One of them had been blown off his track, the most recent one, when they hit a mine, because everybody rode on top, you didn't ride on the inside, and for that very reason. And he had a bad back, and the other had been relieved because the platoon told him he would be fragged if he took him on a particular mission. And so he had been removed, and they had an old sergeant. He's probably 35, but the sergeant had been in the Army 23 years, I think, at the time. His name was James Briley, and but he had, it may have been 27 years that he'd been in the Army, but he was a platoon sergeant, so he's a former cook. But I noticed when I got my Purple Heart orders, it was his third Purple Heart, so he had spent his time in the boonies. When I got there, I let him run the platoon for the first two or three weeks until I noticed he was doing stuff that wasn't safe as far as making sure we had out listening posts and that sort of thing, making sure our perimeter was protected. He would he wouldn't goof off, but he wouldn't be the aggressive leader that you needed to be. And I gradually took over from him. Our men were generally pretty well trained. They were pretty. The ones who had been there longer talked to the others and told them what to do and what not to do. My first test of fire came after a week. But my guys, we were basically a rescue. If a convoy was ambushed, that was our job, was to break it loose. And it was kind of the Aggie way of breaking up a convoy or breaking up an ambush. We would move in the machine guns and drop artillery behind them so they couldn't run, which, I'd rather drop artillery on them. But they had a tendency to be a lot closer than you thought they were. Mm-hmm. Very much closer. I'll tell war stories later. But
could you tell me about your first combat experience?
Sure.
First experience under fire?
We had a rule that we could recon by fire, which we did, but it was always single shot. If you ever fired automatic, that meant that you had contact. And I was sitting, we would get up in the morning and do a mine sweep, and then we would go onto what we call strong points, and we would stand there, or we'd put up our fence out front. We had a chain link fence to catch rockets if they came in. And I don't know the wisdom of that, because the thing that did the damage was a heat rod, and that still came on in. And it would just cause the shrapnel to explode further out, so it'd have a better spread pattern, I think. But still, that was one of the things we had to do. But I never got attacked while I was on strong point. But anyway, I was there. We were waiting for the convoys to go through, and I think both had gone through. And I heard automatic fire coming from my south position, probably a quarter of a mile from me. And everybody was all either loaded or loaded very quickly and left. Riley had stayed where we slept at night. It was our little base. And he swung up on the back, and he had a Prick 25 with him, a radio. And when we got there, he rolled off in the bar ditch and started calling in artillery and a medevac. And because my guys started screaming on the radio, I forgot to tell you that. I heard the automatic fire, but then I heard my squad leader start screaming, and he was using no radio procedure, just goddamn it, you know. And 5-7 was my name over there, or my call sign. And he's got there all over. They shot Murphy. They shot so-and-so, and you know, I'm hit, and goddamn it, you know. And just screaming, yelling, help us. And we got there, and no one was firing. They were all down in the track. And fortunately, we got there fast enough. And I pulled alongside them, and they shot the North Vietnamese were in the tree line, and they fired a rocket grenade at me. And it looked like a white dot coming toward me. And I started firing. I was scared as could be. And they fired a little bit, but not. I think they left a lot sooner than I quit fighting. Strange, I didn't know how I would react, but I fired instantly. I was calling in, trying to get Iron Mike. We had a company commander, had a tank with him. And Iron Mike was the nickname for the tank. And I was screaming, you know, God damn it, get me Iron Mike. The guys have rockets. And my throat constricts, and I can't even fake it now, but I had a real high voice, and it was very tight. And you know, you pucker, but I had an inverted pucker. Mm-hmm. So I was going, I need help, you know. And he was going, and this Strable, who's macho as can be, he goes, calm down, 5-7, I'm on the way, you know. And I go, hurry, hurry, get here. And it was funny, because it took a half an hour for my throat to unconstrict. By the time Strable got there, it took him longer than it should have, I thought. My gun was so hot it was cooking off. And he pulled up and immediately called a ceasefire, because I had my other tracks had joined me. And when he called a ceasefire, my gun was so hot, the breech was, that it exploded. And this is a 50 caliber machine gun. And it fired. It did that about three times, and I got tired of being cussed out. So I opened it, even though if it had fired while I was opening it, I was dead. But I fired 1,500 rounds during that fight, and I had to drive over all the cans.
Now, when you said you did recon by fire, single shot, was that with the 50 cal as well?
Yeah. Okay. Whatever you had. Mm-hmm. The 50 cal just, you know, it loads 100 rounds and loads easily and quickly. But we would, as we were moving, we would fire into suspicious clumps or you know, places where they could be. Mm-hmm. You rarely saw the enemy, not up close.
What about villages in the area? Were there many, or were there many civilian Vietnamese around? Or?
I drove past once or twice. We went in to pick up a convoy, or we took a body in one time. You would see some South Vietnamese. The thing that struck me, I remember there's one little village we drove through that was just on the road where their houses lie in the road, and this would have been Highway 19. And their houses were made out of Coke cans, where they had cut them out, flattened them out, and used them as shingles. And it was an interesting look to it. And those were the more prosperous. Most of the people the people I saw when we would pick up a convoy or I'd go in as pay officer, were the people who would peddle stuff to you, and I didn't like them. They had one little boy that I was just sitting in a Jeep waiting to go back out and take my money, their men, and he came by with sandpaper and scraped my face of my watch, and he wanted a dollar to shine it. Well, the guys that we were with, there was an armor unit. They may have been MPs, because you had those big rubber tire tanks or whatever they're called that led the convoys, actually. Mm-hmm. But if they got into trouble, we were the ones that helped them. But they had a little boy, probably 13. He was a Vietnamese who was dressed in tiger stripes, and he was kind of their mascot. Well, he got the little kid who had done it and persuaded him to buff my watch free, because it was a brand new watch. But when I first got there, my first day, the first convoy had gone by, or one of the first days, and some of my guys came around and they said, we want you to meet somebody. And her name was Kim. And she had on black pajamas and really built well. And she opened it up and said, I souvenir you, boom boom, you let me boom boom GIs, and so you know, Didi Mao, get out of here. And I would not let my guys do that. Some of the officers, when they went in, would buy rubbers for their guys and what have you. I didn't. I didn't allow them to fraternize. We just didn't do that. Because I wasn't. It wasn't a moral issue. It was more of a safety. And I figured they already knew where all my machine guns were at night and everything else. And we just didn't need any more of that. And that was a couple of times I would throw smoke grenades to get them out of from around us.
So that, and that policy of yours was in keeping with the Army policy, or did the Army instruct you? Could your higher command instruct you how you're supposed
to? I'm sure they told us not to, but I don't recall it. And all I know is that some of the lieutenants would allow it, some wouldn't. My unit became pretty strict as far as, I came from being an attack officer, and so when I first got in country, the other officers didn't particularly like me because they remembered their attacks, and so. But my platoon straightened up, and they became pretty good guys, really.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that the platoon that you took over, the platoon leaders prior to you had been threatened with fragging. How serious were those threats, do you think, and were any other members of your platoon ever threatened?
That particular time, I think the threats were just idle. There was a lot of talk about it, but I never once heard of it actually happening. Because it certainly, to my knowledge, never came close to happening to me. They knew after the first week that if they got into a fight, I would be the first one there. In fact, the rule was that you could shoot anything in front of me. And they knew who I was because we carried a skull on a stick. And so I never took point or anything until we got into combat, and then I pulled to the front. And there was another time, a platoon, I think his first platoon, their lieutenant was relieved. It's cold in here. Because he was going to be killed if he took the guys on a particular mission, and it was not a fun mission because we had to walk. And they relieved him. He went back to base camp and sent me to take his platoon on the mission the same day. And I took Briley with me, and Briley was a great big guy. And I came in just like as if I were attack officer, gave a 5-paragraph field order, and told them in Army fucking terms what they would be carrying and when we're moving out. And we moved out, and they were pretty undisciplined. We were going through, circling around a unit. Jacket Kilo was the name of the guy who, or that was his radio name. It was a rough puff, just regional forces. And evidently, they had decided, that it's a mission they should have taken, because we were sweeping around their area. And we swept around this little mountain, and it was real high elephant grass. And we hated elephant grass because you can shoot through it, but you can't see through it. And I had an artillery forward observer with me and his radio man, and then I had the other platoon leader's radio man, and I put us into a kind of a diamond shape with, instead of running individual people, because you can lose somebody, I ran the 4 squads as a diamond with a lead squad doing point, and we kept pretty close together. But I was going slower in the middle, and we lost the point squad. And my radio man, who was the other platoon, he said, "Well, you want me to fire up in the air?" And I go, "Shit, this isn't Fort Dix. You know, they're going to know. They know where we are. And that's all we need is to start a firefight with our own people." So I told everybody to lay down. And we laid down, and in about 20 minutes, we heard them, or 10 minutes, we heard them whispering, you know, wanting to know. And then from then on, they stayed in tight. We made the little sweep. I went back, and I went back to my own platoon. But as far as fragging, it didn't happen. I talked to my medic 28 years after I missed him. He was the only other college graduate in the unit with me. And I talked to him about it, and he said, "Well, you may not have ever known about it. And in fact, I think it was before you got there. But my driver, he had a Polish name, played a harmonica. But he also had a Gooks belt on that he wore, and he had a 30 caliber North Vietnamese rifle he had taken off one of them, and it shot 30 caliber. And I think it was in the mortar platoon, and my medic said that he went in and they were all talking one night at how they would fake a firefight, and they'd leave a lane open so that somebody could get out. Actually, the guy was going to sneak out, the guy with the 30 cal, and or this was the plan, as told me 28 years later by my medic. He would sneak out, and when Briley lit his cigar at night, he usually sat up on top of the bridge, and it'd be easy to shoot. And they were going to fire, and they were going to leave a lane open for the guy with the rifle to come back in, and so he would have been shot with a enemy rifle. And my medic told the guy, says, "Well, you'll have to shoot me too, because I'm not going to let you do it." And it was just guys talking. I don't think they ever would have really done it, and they didn't.
What really motivated that kind of activity or that kind of attitude towards other officers or NCOs?
I think if they weren't decisive, if they weren't fair, if they did stuff that they told you not to, you just. Well, I've got letters back from my men that said that we thought you were hard on us, but you were never harder on us than you were on yourself. I actually walked flank one day just to see how tough it was to keep up, and it was damn tough, because it's like on a minesweep or something. You can walk faster swinging. I thought we were going real slow, but you get out there in the brush, and it's tough, especially when it's raining and things like that. But after the first couple of fights, they knew that they could count on me, and they also knew that I didn't make them do foolish things. Captain Strable had taken, I told you this yesterday, when my guys were back at base camp waiting to have an officer, the zappers came through and blew up all the trucks that started. The ones that wouldn't start, they didn't touch. And so their intelligence was pretty good. Mm-hmm. But they came in one side of the camp and out the other. Because the zappers weren't there to shoot at you. They were there just to blow up stuff or throw satchel charges into sleeping quarters and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, Strable took my men and took them and chased the Gooks and killed them and brought their weapons back. And I say Gooks now, and that's just because that's what we called them. I mean, no disrespect or anything, because they were doing their job. They were closer to home than I was. But what would be frustrating, I guess. I saw them one time coming through a clearing. I don't know, they were about 4,500 meters from me. And it was exact range of my mortar, so it was 43, 42, but I could see it. And the way they carried their rifles and their uniforms were different. I don't know why they had the audacity to walk through a clearing, but you could see like three of them at a time coming through, but they were 2 or 3 miles away, and they would not allow me to fire on them. And I could have had 3 rounds in the air before the first one hit. But I called Jack at Kilo, and he said all my men are in the wire, and wouldn't let me shoot. And later we went out and found bunkers and things that they had built, because they were coming from, ironically, from the east. Most of them came from the west, from Cambodia.
Okay.
But we did meet these guys later. They attacked a convoy a couple of days later.
Did you ever find out the rationale for not being allowed to fire on them?
We did not. Well, they could have walked in formation down the road, and unless they fired on me, I was not allowed to fire on them.
So those are the rules of engagement? If you were not engaged, you could not engage?
That's right.
Was that because you were in a defensive posture, or is that just a standard?
It's probably a defensive posture, and to make sure that we don't hit an Arvin unit by mistake, or hit one of our own units.
Okay.
The last day, I killed one of them, and I was watching his body bounce, and I realized he had a green uniform on, and I thought I'd kill one of my own men. Later, because they had changed uniforms, they weren't wearing khakis, they weren't green.
Mm-hmm.
Later, they thought we were all dead, and I was just unlocking my turret so I could spin, but I'd been shot a couple of times. But all my men were either wounded or unconscious or something,
mm-hmm.
and they were all wearing green uniforms, and I was very happy,
mm-hmm.
and also had 100 rounds of ammo.
Okay.
So, but that was what was frustrating, is that you couldn't fire until you were fired upon.
Mm-hmm.
Equally frustrating is that we would run up and down, getting closer to the town, we would pass the Arvin units, and they would all be in clean uniforms. Their APCs were clean, and we were doing the fighting. They weren't, and that was very frustrating.
Did your men share that frustration?
Yes.
Did you talk about it a lot?
Didn't talk about it a lot. It just it was there.
Okay.
We did not like the Arvins, mm-hmm. and I had nothing to do with them. You know, Jim Reckner here was with an Arvin unit for 2 years, or different units. And he grew really to like them and respect them. I just had no interaction except negative, you know. I did work with the Mountain Yards, and I loved them. They were very honest, very primitive people, but I loved the Yards. They, one of them named Bray, he was probably four or five, but we were moving, he would help me fill sandbags. And he was kind of privileged because his uniform, instead of just the sash they all wore, he had a very small army pajama top that he wore. Mm-hmm. And the women wore just long wraparound skirts, and that was quite a shock for young guys mm-hmm. who've been in the army for a long time. Bray worked with me. He was my laundryman. I had two sets of jungle fatigues. He would wash one. And every week I would change whether they were dirty or not. But God, they must have stunk. But he'd wash them in the runoff of a rice paddy. Mm-hmm. But it was a fresh pair. And I left my wallet in it one time, and he brought it back to me. And I would give them food and sea ration. The only thing they ever spit out was a chocolate fudge that my mother had sent. And it was an old Vietnamese woman, and a Mountain Yard. And she didn't like chocolate at all, but they chewed the betel nuts and that sort of thing, had bad teeth, mm-hmm. but good people.
You mentioned earlier that you had worked with some rural forces or rough puffs. Can you explain a little bit more about them and how your units interacted with them and how good of fighters they were or bad? Or?
I never saw them fight during the whole time I was there. I went in to see Jack at Kilo. Because I was supposed to meet him since I was camped about, quarter of a mile, if that far away from the Rough Puff camp. And they ordered us to have ways that I would help it with defense in case he got hit. And basically, the way we were going to do it, we'd have one of our tracks stay back, provide cover. The other three would dash in, spin around, use covering fire. He'd get in the back and we'd leave. But... But he had a nice hooch. He had a refrigerator. He had cold cokes, and I'll never know his name. We got hit one night, and he had a mortar, and I was directing artillery fire from Artillery Hill and using all the coordinates, and then from LZ Joyce, we had 105s coming in there. But the best fire was coming from Jack at Kilo, and he kept, I was giving him 2 degrees left and right and all this, and he says 5-7. I'm just kicking the fucking butt plate. I don't have a what do you call it? It's like a sextant on the side of it. He said, I'm just kicking the butt plate. I'd tell him left, he'd kick it. But he was the most accurate of all the people.
Wow.
But we had one fight. We had something coming. We heard movement out in the wire. And we fired, and it froze. And then later we heard movement. We were scared to death because it was coming in. And finally, we saw it, and it was a panther. And immediately I ordered white phosphorus. And so it scared the cat away. But it was just a full-size panther that was coming down the side of the road, mm-hmm. and it got through the wire, and it ran.
You mentioned earlier also some experiences with the Kit Carsons, those that were assigned to
mm-hmm.
you. Was there any problems with the Kit Carsons? Any concerns over them engaging in spying or anything like that?
No, because Choke was the one we had most of the time. The other one came, but he didn't stay long. He went back. Choke, I asked him how he left his other unit, his North Vietnamese unit. He said he killed his platoon leader. I said, well, anytime you want to leave, just DD. And I would have let him. It didn't bother me. But he's the one who would find blood trails after fights.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange. We it happened two or three times. And really, where they went, the tracks couldn't go, and we weren't really, well, we were outnumbered.
Mm-hmm.
And I, two or three times, identified the blood trails as probably water buffalo. And they said, okay, but you don't have to go. And I don't know how they thought a lieutenant, second lieutenant at that, could identify water, tell the difference. It was early DNA testing that we did. But we basically didn't want to go. Because they sent me on one mission, if we still have tape.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the first time I realized that they smelled differently than we did. Because we had to leave our tracks, and we went down, and they had typical foxholes. And the foxholes would be like a yard wide, maybe, and then 6 foot. Mm-hmm. And then they'd dig them down, and then about 3 feet down, they would dig back into the wall of the foxhole and put grass, and that would be their sleeping quarters. Mm-hmm. And then they'd put poles that they stood on so that they didn't stand in the water because it rained all the time. Mm-hmm. It's ingenious, and it rather... be kind of cool down there. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we were clamoring down to get to them, and they were trying to get them pretty fast. And they left, they ran, and we were probably making too much noise. But of course, I'm sure they heard the armored personnel carriers. And when we got there, the fires were still going, and they had dropped several sacks of rice. The rice was carried in a tube sock, a white sock, and they slung it around their shoulders. And my radio man came up and said, 5-7, do you realize they've got more two-man bunkers than we have men? And I said, I think it's time for the artillery to take these guys. And so I figured they had run to the blue line or the stream downstairs. And I walked artillery there, and we moved back to the road, and I walked it back up through their camp, and we left.
So in those kinds of operations, you wouldn't go back in for a body count to see how many you might have killed? Or
no, because usually by the time that happened, it was getting dark, and... they own the nights.
Mm-hmm. Now, what and how would you report that kind of an action up the chain of command?
I would report how many we found, and I never did give a false body count. Mm-hmm. I didn't.
Was that a problem in adjacent units to you? The
Not
issue
really.
Of the body count. And what did lieutenants and your commanding officers think of this? Fixation, because of course that was something that came down the chain from people like Secretary of Defense McNamara. Mm-hmm. You know, the individuals who wanted to quantify progress in the war, and therefore an emphasis on body counting. What did you and your fellow officers think about that?
Well, the colonel would always come by and ask, or radio and ask, how many bodies, and there were rarely that we would find their bodies because they would drag them off, or one of them they already had a trench dug and put him in it as they left, and we found him. Mm-hmm. I remember the colonel asking me one time about, are you sure you killed anybody? And I said, well, I did, and I described where I shot him, and or, you know, where in his body. And he said, well, shit, we've already found him. So they needed counts, but we didn't give them fake ones.
Were there any rumors of maybe not your unit, but other units that you were near to, that they engaged in falsification, or did you ever hear any incidents
happening? Well, I read about it. There was one story that it's Reds jump convoy and get clobbered, and we lost a guy named Parker on that deal. He wasn't in my platoon, but there was a body count given there, and the bodies weren't there. Probably we killed some of them, but... you rarely saw them directly, but it was like reading like a Western novel when you read it, or a sports article, because it was written about how great and brave and all we were, and how we had really beat up on this group, and it wasn't the case. We did win, but in fact, that particular time, we were a blocking force, and... And I heard it, and I've listened, played it over in my mind as many times I can see it. So, because I know the terrain and everything, but I really couldn't see it when it happened. But they shot a chopper down because we were working with Cobras. I love working with them. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't know whether it was Cobra or not, but the chopper was down, and when Captain Strable got there, the North Vietnamese was inside going through the, I don't know whether he was killing the people in there or what. But it was the chopper's on its side, and he jumped out and ran, and I will always remember Strable hollering, going, get him, yee-haw, get him, and you could hear the tracks grunting as they worked him, and someone shot him with an M16. It hit him in the elbow, and came out out the back of his hand. Mm-hmm. I hated M16s, but you shoot them with a 50, and that's right. Mm-hmm. But
where was this now?
This was about 12 clicks north of Pleiku. It was right where I worked, and we were there. We were lined up just over on behind a little hill. But if any of them came over the hill, we had them. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they knew that or not.
What size was the enemy force? Did you know?
Probably a company size.
And these were Pavin regulars,
mm-hmm.
or
okay. Yeah. That's all we ever fought.
So you never really had to engage in what are referred to as the Viet Cong, mm-hmm. the indigenous South Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, this was 69, and as I left, mm-hmm. right after when I got a letter back from my medic, he said they were turning it over to the Arvins. Mm-hmm. But he also, I'll give you a copy of his letter. Mm-hmm. He said they were being attacked with sometimes strictly B-40 rockets. Mm-hmm. And because they were well supplied by then, if they can waste those B-40s. And I think our company was down to about 8 or 9 tracks, mm-hmm. and could have been overrun. In fact, he says if we hadn't had a Rome plow with us, it would have been the end.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier when you took over the platoon, one of the operations you were on, you were dismounted for the
yes.
majority of that. Was what were the, I guess, the rules for dismounting? Did your units dismount often? Did your platoon dismount a lot? Or
it was strictly dependent on the terrain. Mm-hmm. We would take the tracks in as far as we could, and we would, and then, you know, there were certain places we just flat couldn't get tracks into, mm-hmm. and we would leave them, dismount, and go out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't like it.
You didn't
like it? No. But then the straight leg grunts didn't like riding with us.
Mm-hmm.
See, we loved having all the ammo and all the water, mm-hmm. everything we wanted right there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 12 machine guns. I had 550s and I guess 7 M60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of weapons.
And lots of ammunition.
Never ran low on ammo. No.
Okay.
It was, like I say, I fired 1,500 rounds and I don't think, you were resupplied every day with whatever you needed. Except I had 145 at the time. I later had one or two others. And I've carried a 145, but I carried 45, but I carried it under my shirt because I didn't want people knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I ordered ammo and they sent me a case of it, which is, you know, a box that big. We wanted Cokes. And they said, you have to buy a flat, which is like 116 cases. And I go, that's too many. We did have a Coke truck hit a mine, though. And they left it on the road beside us. And we evacuated several cases of Cokes, about as many as we thought we could carry. But the Army was kind of funny in what they resupply.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever concerned that your APCs were so loud that they were going to give you away and give the advantage to the enemy?
No. In fact, I thought they would intimidate, and we went in with our hair on fire.
Mm-hmm.
We were firing it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, that they ran. They didn't want to be there when we got there.
Mm-hmm.
Where a straight leg grunt, you know, you're one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
There was one thing at Playboy. We were on two missions. The first mission was a guy named Fritz, who was a spook, and I had seen him once in base camp. He wore uniform, but no insignia and no rank, no name, no U.S. Army on it. And I think our entire company was involved in this. There was, I believe it was Playboy, and there's a village. Let me look at the map. This village right here, Playook or
mm-hmm.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We hit Playboy. There was something going on right in here all mm-hmm. the time. And I slept right here most of the time, I believe.
Yeah. At the intersection near benchmark 716, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, because the road was right up from us. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we surrounded Playboy because we were, LZ Joyce is here,
mm-hmm.
and we came down the road as fast as we could, and they were riding with us,
mm-hmm.
and surrounded it except for this, like the little blue line here,
mm-hmm.
and that's where Fritz was, and whoever ran, Fritz got.
Okay.
Because people think of the, you know, like a sniper.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was a sniper with claymores and stuff. I mean, he didn't. This is night. And somebody ran. Later, they sent me on a mission here, and I went up the road.
To Playook.
Playook. Uh-huh. I went up the road, came in, I came across, because it was flatter. And as we got about where that little blue line is, my guy said, 5-7, you got to come up here and see this. It's weird. And this was about 5 in the afternoon. And I could see the village through the trees, and I swung out in front of them and fell into a tank trap. Turned us on our sides. They were ready for us. And they had a trench dug around Playook that you couldn't get a track through. You couldn't get a tank through. The walls were too steep. And since we had hit a tank trap, and there was no one in the village, no animals, nothing. And I was in constant contact with the company and battalion. This time, battalion. And, of course, company's listening in. But it was a perfect, there were no weeds. The crops were perfectly tended, but no one was there. And there was one dirt road, or bridge, culvert kind of thing going in. And I knew the sucker would be mined. And, again, this is where my troops didn't ask, knew I didn't do foolish things. And so I told them what the deal was, and they said, we don't have time to get people in there, come on back, but check it out on the way back. And on the way back, we started finding spider holes and tunnels. Mm-hmm. And so that was marked for a later mission. Mm-hmm. About a week later is when I got shot, and I was turned in for a Silver Star, and I thought if I deserved a star for it, that my driver did. My driver was shot going in. So he was shot through the cheek, so it wasn't a major wound, but it was just a crease, and he turned out to 5-7, I've been hit, and I said, well, can you still drive? And he said, yeah. And later, bullets bouncing off my bat wings, hit him in the back of the head, knocked him out. But he was brave. And
why don't you go ahead and describe the incidents of surrounding you getting shot and the operation that you were conducting or the attack?
Okay, let me just finish up on this play first.
Certainly. Okay, I'm sorry.
Because I was shot, I was medevaced out, and I would have been executive officer at the fire base. And in talking to my medic, they started taking trips out. Anyway, I recommended my driver for a star also. Mm-hmm. I got a letter back from the Army that said my captain was dead. And so I wrote and it just said, Captain Calum's reported deceased 16 September, it's 1969. Mm-hmm. I found out later that from some guys in the artillery there that were stationed at Fort Sill, that my colonel and my captain had been flying over that same village, and they shot through the roof and shot a rocket grenade at them and blew them out of the air. If I hadn't been wounded, I would have been XO, but I knew where it was. I knew where the tunnels were. Mm-hmm. I would have been in the damn chopper. So getting shot saved my life.
Wow.
Okay. Tell you about the incident.
Yeah.
That was 4th of September. I was senior, been there since May 15th, and I was senior lieutenant. And so I was going to get to be executive officer, and we had a place called LZ Joyce. And Captain Kalin had that, and he had renamed it. And Joyce was his wife's name. And they pulled me back in, and my platoon, we had like 2 or 3 days where we were just security for this little fire base. They had 4 guns. And I was getting ready. I'd already bought me a radio, and I bought me a lantern. And it's going to be a nice duty compared, because most people hated it. But that sure beats sleeping out under a tent, under a bridge. Mm-hmm. Ho Chi Minh died, and we had an international ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And there were 2 convoys, but the northern one came down, then the one from south to north was the second convoy. And it was about 11 o'clock. And my world was great. We've had a ceasefire. I'm coming back to a fire base. My replacement's on a convoy. And about a quarter of a mile from us, they ambushed the convoy. And we heard the automatic fire. And I was out with another track burning weeds that had grown up in the concertina wire. It probably wasn't safe, but it wasn't very safe there, period. Where you just light a match and then you'd spray diesel on it. And that's how you, and as long as you kept it burning, you were okay. Don't let it come back in. But that's how we burn. Anyway, I heard automatic fire, and I ran from the wire to my track, and I loaded up. Earlier that day on the first convoy, a Stars and Stripes reporter, my platoon had been engaged in a lot of things that had been written about, but nothing major. But it was kind of, finding a mine, I'll tell you about that.
Okay.
Anyway, he was there to do a day in the life of an infantry platoon leader. And so when I dashed back, he was standing beside the track. And I said, "You want to go?" And he said, "Hell no," you know, because he knew where we were going. But we had a cook there that from Kantoon that was bringing breakfast down for everybody. And he had made his trip because he did it between convoys. And he's in Cook's Whites. And he went with us. And my driver always cleaned my 50 for me, but he always left it on single shot. And I never knew which was which. I sound like a dumbass, so it really wasn't. So to find out, I mashed down on the butterflies, and it fired one shot right in front of my company commander as he was coming out. And I remember him looking over at me, and he was kind of like, "What in the hell are you doing?" But he was on out. Then my platoon was the second group out, and Captain Kalin went further down the road before he turned in. And I turned in right at the convoy and right into him. And we were shooting at flashes, and you could hear the bullets going by. I even had the little CVC, command vehicle, mm-hmm. whatever combat vehicle commander's hat on. Mm-hmm. And I never thought that strange until lately when because it's pretty well padded, mm-hmm. but we were getting so many rounds fired at us. Of course, they were hitting the track, too, and it's like somebody bounding on it with a machine gun. Mm-hmm. It wasn't hurting the track. And Sergeant Warford, I had two sergeants. He was a buck sergeant. He came running up, and they said, "They've shot Briley." And I said, "Well, where's Briley?" And he said, "I'll show you." And we got on the track and started toward them. And we weren't taking tremendous fire, but I can remember them whizzing past. And we were shooting M16s because we were up shooting, sitting shoulder to shoulder, to mm-hmm. shoulder, kneeling. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, he just disappeared. And they hit him in the widow's peak and underneath his helmet. And he flew off. Nobody died that day on our side. Briley was shot through the stomach, came out his back, and he had a bruised liver. And Warford had a concussion. My driver, by then, he said, "I've been hit," and he could still drive, and he drove just a little bit. And we came over a little hill, and there was a guy 20 feet from me, raised up to shoot me, and I shot him right between. I was on top of him, so I hit him in the base of his neck, right between his shoulders. And I'm sure the first bullet killed him, but I shot him three more times in the back. His body flipped over, and I broke his legs backwards. And I shot him six times. I shot six times and hit him six. But he was so damn close. Mm-hmm. And that's when I thought I'd killed one of my own men. We were getting most of the fire from the right. Somewhere along in here is when bullets bounced off my bat wings. My driver went unconscious. And most of the fire to the right, I couldn't get it. I kept trying, and I ran out of ammo. And my radio operator stood up to give me ammo, and I took it, and I just about to cock it, and I saw him get shot through the neck, and blood trickled down both sides. And as I loaded my machine gun, I had a hold of the cocking lever, and I got hit, and I thought I'd been kicked. And I thought, that's strange, because there's not anybody around here to kick you. And I reached I was the only one. The others had been shot too by now, or were helping the medic or something. One guy had panicked, and most of the fire was coming from the right, so they had seen me, fall back and reach. My left arm didn't work, so I stuck it in my pants, and I knew I could turn my turret if I undid the toggle switch. Mm-hmm. So I just laid forward, and it took me a second to find it. And when I was raised back up, they were walking toward me, and they were. They're carrying their rifles down. That's the way they carried them. One of them, there were four or five of them, and they were well-dressed, good, cleaner than I was. And the one on the far right realized I only had one arm and was using the recoil on the 50 to back it around to him. And we were kind of at an angle aimed down, and the 50's barrel's heavy. Mm-hmm. But I knew I was going to be able to get to him. Mm-hmm. They started running, and he knew he had a little more time, and he threw a grenade at me. And I could, everything goes in slow motion, but I was watching the barrel come around to get these guys, and watching the grenade, and I was trying to figure out. I said, "Now, does our arm in 12 meters or 12 feet, or is it 4 seconds?" And I was trying. I wonder if theirs do too, because I think I could have caught it and thrown it back because it was like a can with a stick on it, mm-hmm. and it's a Chacon grenade, mm-hmm. and. We had explosions going off all around us, and I don't know if it went off or not, but I decided I only have one arm. You don't have enough ammo to come back. Mm-hmm. So by the time I got around to where he was, I was out of ammo again and really had no chance of reloading. Mm-hmm. And I looked down and said, let's get the hell out of Dodge. And because they had Warford in the track, Briley was in a ditch, and another group was handling him. Mm-hmm. And we were the Lone Ranger out there. And a guy, he happened to be a black guy. The blacks were as brave as the whites, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. But he was shaking, and he grabbed my, when I said, let's get the hell out of Dodge, he grabbed my driver and threw him in the middle of the track on top of the other wounded. And I couldn't get down because there were wounded all over. And I jumped off the back of the track, and the driver put it in reverse. And so we've got machine guns shooting at us and kicking up dirt and stuff. It was Keystone Cops. And finally, I was trying to avoid getting run over. Mm-hmm. And the door swung open, and my medic, it was a conscientious objector, he wasn't the good medic I spoke about earlier, he pulled me in, and I remember I was laying there, and he was trying to bandage my shoulder, because well, it had swollen up like a grapefruit, but it wasn't bleeding much in the front, it had hit the bones and gone out my back, and it was kind of ragged on the back, but you know, he was having trouble getting this bandage to stay on. And he said, his glasses were hanging down, and he said, sir, you'll have to excuse me, I've had a bad day. You know, mine has been peachy. But the guy who panicked got us back, and they said, how many stretchers do you need? And I don't remember, three or four. And they said, no, you need one more, because you need one. Mm-hmm. And they put us on stretchers, and medevac wouldn't land, because they were taking rockets in the firebase. And they moved us into a little bunker for a while, and the lieutenant, or I guess he was the captain of the artillery, I mean, because our sidewalks were made out of artillery boxes, mm-hmm. and the rest was just like, you know, like knee-deep mud. Mm-hmm. He had to get off because they were carrying us, and I saw the Stars and Stripes reporter, and he was terrified. Mm-hmm. But they wouldn't land the medevac, and I had sat down in the mud and leaned up against the bamboo pole that was our antenna, that we had our antenna on, and I remember watching the rockets coming in. They looked kind of pretty. But I was on two shots of morphine by then. But they still wouldn't land medevacs. And the artillerymen, and one of your questions was, what's the bravest thing you saw? Mm-hmm. These artillerymen were unarmed, and they carried us out the other side of the firebase and into a little valley, mm-hmm. and the chopper landed, and they loaded us on, and two of them were unconscious, and they had to strap them in pretty good. Mm-hmm. My radio man, we had time, he and I sitting on with our legs hanging out of the chopper, and he asked for water, and you know, I had a canteen. I said, it's gonna run out both sides of your neck, but nothing, it did not hit anything major. It went through his neck, and I swear to God, I could see the blood coming out. They had a bandage on it by then, but I gave him water, and we took off. And I can remember watching the artillerymen running, carrying the stretchers, you know, but and they didn't have weapons. But
wow, now the medevacs, was that something that your unit had called in a lot on before, or was mm-hmm. this?
Oh, every week or two.
Every week or two.
Mm-hmm. And how many? Somebody. You know, you know, we took about 30-40% casualties in that 4 months. Mm-hmm. But I did not have a single guy maimed or killed.
The entire time you were there?
Uh-huh.
Wow. And no one was killed in that operation that you were... were wounded.
I was probably the most seriously wounded, although mm-hmm. I was still lucid and uh-huh. and my right arm worked. Uh-huh. And basically, that's what the action was for, was continuing to fight even though you're wounded. Mm-hmm. One of the citations said, although... See, citations are written by people who weren't there, so they have no clue. Mm-hmm. And we were just trying to help Briley and mm-hmm. to break the convoy loose, which we did. Mm-hmm. But medevacs, I saw several of them, but they would not land if they were going to be shot down, and you don't blame them. Because we did very little, since we were mainly a daytime unit. Mm-hmm. We put out listening posts, but that was for our own protection. We didn't have enough men to really put out ambushes, mm-hmm. Jacket Kilo would do that, and the straight leg grunts would handle the ambushes. Our job was in early mornings, mine sweep, then stand guard for the convoys. Then we would go out on med caps, where we would go to the mountain yard villages and take care of their wounded. And we always stopped. They always had the lepers at a little hut downstream, and we would go down and tend to them. After that, we normally had a mission of some kind, which would be you need to check out hill so and so or whatever. And usually we would find foxholes or bunkers, not always. Resupply. We had one mission that came down at 5 in the afternoon. That there was a resupply mission to a special forces camp on the border of, well, it was 12 or 15 clicks west of the highway. The highway's barely a two-lane road. But it had gotten into an ambush, and they'd all been blown up. And they desperately wanted to get the stuff to the special forces camp. Mm-hmm. That was the only night mission, really, that was major. And I tried every way to, you know, don't we have helicopters or somebody else who can do this? And they said, no, we're sending the convoy from Khantoum. And these were armored personnel carriers, except they were trucks and they were track vehicles. And they told me where I'd meet them. And I met them on this next road. It was just, I don't know what this road is, mm-hmm. but...
It's a road that intersects with Highway 14?
Yes.
In the northern quadrant of...
Yeah, of course we weren't going to take it. Mm-hmm. And the Special Forces camp was somewhere like over here. Mm-hmm. And we met them, and I did not want to take the road because I figured it would be ambushed. Mm-hmm. And I went through these lakes... around, mm-hmm. went through one ambush that, we had to change radio frequency several times because mm-hmm. we were going into different units. Mm-hmm. One ambush that we had set up somewhere along in here, mm-hmm. I'm not sure, mm-hmm. but I met the convoy here with my tracks, and it's difficult to read a compass inside it or mm-hmm. with all the metal around,
right.
But I did use dead reckoning to get through, and we got to about here, maybe click and a half, something like that, mm-hmm. and they said 5-7, come forward. And so I pulled up in front of my lead track, and there were the carcasses of the armored personnel carriers that they were upside down, and they had burned out. And I had just, by you know, luck or accident or misluck, mm-hmm. had taken the same road in that they had been going in the daytime, because mm-hmm. they had pulled all the men and any weapons they could out, but mm-hmm. they had not yet picked them up. But we hit them there, went all the way through.
Wow.
The command sergeant major of Special Forces, or sergeant major anyway, met us at the gate and walked us in. He was real happy to see us. Mm-hmm. And that was, it was without incident, but it was scary as could be, especially when you run across where the other guys had been killed. And they were killed in the daytime, and we were taking them in at night.
Wow. What kind of night vision devices did you have?
We had infrared that didn't work. Well, we didn't have the goggles or whatever it takes to look and the that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. We had night scopes that we used in training, and I love those. And it seemed like one track in our company was fitted with a infrared night scope, mm-hmm. but we didn't have them. Those starlight scopes were wonderful, but we didn't have one.
Okay.
The best thing we had, we always at night. We would pull a flare mortar, and any time we had action, that was the first, you know, they just automatically dropped that, and then we start looking. Mm-hmm. But that's scary, too, because especially when you have more than one flare coming down, everything seems to be moving out there because they're swaying, mm-hmm. and those shadows move, mm-hmm. and it's eerie.
So most evenings, did you lay up just in a defensive perimeter?
Very much, very tight. We had four main points where with machine guns that were manned all night, and you took 1 hour shifts. I put an LZ down the stream. Mm-hmm. They weren't far, 30 or 40 yards, but mm-hmm. they were, you know, outside our wire. Mm-hmm. We had wire that we drug across the road. And like I say, I had a lot of claymores, mm-hmm. and all the way around us were pre-plotted artillery positions, mm-hmm. that, you know, I could call red one or whatever I wanted.
Did you get engaged very often in the evenings or at night?
No? Not after that first time when they tried and we were so ready. Mm-hmm. But I was skeptical that night because that afternoon there was an old mountain yard that walked up to the Jack at Kilo, mm-hmm. and I think that's where we got the intelligence. Mm-hmm. And he was drunk. When I turned in my resupply, I ordered, it was something like a whiskey barrel, and that meant tank. And it was Kalen then, or Strabel, I can't remember who it was, said, "We've only got one, and I'm keeping it." But he said, "I'll be there, don't worry." Mm-hmm. Didn't make it.
Okay.
No, he made it much later. But we did, sometimes we'd do thunder runs at night, or where we would just run up and down the road. Mm-hmm. And Iron Mike did that more than anybody else, just to make, just to scare them, really.
Make your presence be known.
Yeah. Because on more than one occasion, I woke up and down the road a stretch, I would see a trail where, 100 of them had crossed, and it'd be muddy going across the road. Mm-hmm. So, and they left, if I've got one or not, they left propaganda for us, mm-hmm. telling about how bad the war was, and mm-hmm. our mothers wanted us to come home.
Did you often have soldiers fall asleep while on duty at night, or was that ever a problem?
Not when you shoot over the head with a .45, it tends to wake them up.
Okay. So that solved most of the problems.
My listening post, because I woke up every hour. Uh-huh. These were some of ours. Propaganda, and that's one that they had. Mm-hmm. But I was up almost every hour, and I would go in and break squelch, and if they didn't answer me with two clicks, mm-hmm. I would fire over their heads. Mm-hmm. Not at them, mm-hmm. just to wake them up. Mm-hmm. And I would fire, and you hear this click, click, everything's fine.
And that would be the end of it?
Mm-hmm.
No disciplinary action or anything like that? Yeah. Did you ever have to take disciplinary action against some of your soldiers? Or?
Yeah. Only had one that was a goof off when I got there. He had been before I got there. He had been going around a clump of bushes or whatever, mm-hmm. and ran smack into a North Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. North Vietnamese had a grenade, threw it and hit my guy in the chest. The North Vietnamese was so scared he forgot to jam it, to arm it, like pull the pin, because I think they just stuck the stick down in the can. That's how they activated theirs. Mm-hmm. So the grenade just bounced off this guy's chest. And they both ran. So, but he was too terrified to go on patrols or anything after that. Mm-hmm. And we had gone on the sweep where we had found the more foxholes than we had men. And I came back and he was sunbathing up on top of the bunker. And so from then on, he had to go with us. Yes, the funniest thing. And this guy was a real goof off. He'd already had an Article 15, and mm-hmm. and but all I did was put him back to work. Mm-hmm. And when we were at LZ Joyce, we got probed one night, and he was outside. And a month or so earlier, a General Pepke had designed a W-shaped foxhole, where you had three places then trenches, three firing places, and then trenches that came back where you had your ammo stored. And it was an ingenious for West Texas, but in the monsoons, it wasn't too good, and so it was full of water. Well, that wasn't all. We had a two-holer where you had, for a latrine, and the guys would carry the stuff out, and they were supposed to burn it with diesel, and they'd burn it for about 15 minutes and dump it in General Pepke's bunker. And this had been going on a month. Well, the goof-off guy, I was in a bunker, and it was raining, and we got probed, and we were fine, but wasn't a battle, really. They were just trying to get through the wire, and we were trying to shoot them. Mm-hmm. And he was outside, and he started running, fell all the way under, came in, and everyone in the room stopped firing. And they, told him to get out. And he said, "Shit, no, there's a fight going on." And they said, "Get out, or there's a fight going on in here." And they actually turned a gun on him. And and he got outside, stripped naked except for his boots, and then we let him come back in. God, he's done. But it couldn't have happened to a better guy.
That pamphlet you just showed me, which was propaganda that the Vietnamese would leave for Americans to find, what kind of effect did that ever have? And
we laughed at it because, will they be here? Just some of their English is so bad. Mm-hmm. And it shows pictures of the anti-war. This is why we don't like the protesters.
Mm-hmm.
Son, come back home. Don't make me suffer thinking you can die without glory in this dirty war.
So it was not, it didn't have the desired effect that the Vietnamese wanted. Was morale in your platoon and in your company high for most of the time you were there?
Most of the time. There's nothing higher than after a little firefight, because mm-hmm. you can smell the ozone, you can smell mm-hmm. the gunfire mm-hmm. or gunpowder, mm-hmm. and you really are high, mm-hmm. You know, if you didn't take bad casualties. Mm-hmm. And we didn't usually take any, because most of the fights were very short. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty, we had good security. My guys were well trained. It's like when I fell into the tank trap, we had done other things. Well, where we were coming up to a village and we'd throw a track. Well, first time something like that happened, it takes an hour to get a track back on. Mm-hmm. I immediately put out security on all four points. We had machine guns out there. We had backup folks. We had claymores out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, without even having to give an order, when my track was turned on its side, my men automatically went into the perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't get hit.
So there's no training like combat.
That's true. There was one time that we were going into a village. We were just making a run to it, but we were online running into it. And I did look out, and everybody had mosquito spray out and spraying.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, God damn, put that down and get your gun.
You also showed me a couple of other items, in particular, code of conduct card.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, how important was that to you and to your soldiers? Was there ever really any fear of being captured? And what role would that code of conduct have played if you had that?
I think we would have tried very hard. There was very little that any of we lieutenants had as far as knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been very valuable to the North Vietnamese that they couldn't get from a hooch girl or something else. I mean, I only heard of one incident in our battalion where a lieutenant had been knocked unconscious and zappers were dragging him back into the tree line. And he woke up, and they put a satchel charge on his chest and blew him up. So they didn't take prisoners. We didn't either.
Mm-hmm.
We had one guy surrounded. I wasn't in on the unit when it was, and everybody was shouting, "Chuhoy, Chuhoy," and he raised his rifle. And he had four armored personnel carriers around him. So they didn't
surrender. Did you have anybody ever surrender?
Nope. We were never in any big fights, and there was always a place for them to run, generally, and
mm-hmm.
a place for us to go to.
Mm-hmm.
No, okay. We didn't. We well, had, mm-hmm. this is one that I'd like, we'll talk about how we handle it. When the time when the guy was running, he got hit in the elbow and it came out his arm,
mm-hmm.
The colonel wanted him for questioning, and they told the choppers to land and take him back to Pleiku. The chopper landed, and of course he was wounded, and went up about 40 feet, tilted, and he fell out. Got cussed out, and they said, "Mark him." And they laid a red smoke grenade in his face to mark where he was. They landed, and the chopper left, and they were back on line real quick, because this is one of their buddies had just been killed,
mm-hmm.
and the guy was in either killing him or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonel asked, "Did you get him back to play coup? How did you?" And he said, "We got to about 400 feet and he jumped out again." So, and we thought it was hilarious. But you're totally desensitized.
And you don't think he jumped, or do you?
He was unconscious. I didn't see it,
mm-hmm.
but I heard it. Mm-hmm. So when I was a blocking force.
Were there many incidents like that, or was that kind of an isolated incident?
It was very isolated.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, once word got out about the atrocities at My Lai...
Oh, we thought that was horrible.
Right, and I guess the general tenor of the forces, American forces, was, you know, this was horrible, this is not the kind of stuff that should happen or does happen.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, the popular perception is My Lai is indicative of American forces in Vietnam.
Hmm.
And so,
this was in the heat of a battle where he had shot the thing down and then was inside either killing the pilot or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Pilot was dead.
Mm-hmm.
You're and we're still in a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
I had couldn't remember why I went into a battalion headquarters one time, but I was sitting on strong point, and this was, I told you, the guys were coming down, mm-hmm. and they had a little wing over Piper Cub or whatever it's called, and it was a forward air controller, and he was looking in the woods, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden I watched him, he exploded, and they shot him, and I remember watching it fall, and I called it in, and can I go after him? And do you think he's alive? And I said, no, he's not. And they said, no, we'll send a team in. And they sent a team in that deployed, and then they rappelled out. And I don't know why they didn't take the body. They brought me the body, and it was wrapped in ponchos, and for me to take it to Khantoum the next day. And I had forgotten. I remember going. Being graves registration, I remember going into Khantoum. That was the first time into the camp there, because mm-hmm. they made us unload our weapons, which made me very nervous. Mm-hmm. But we had to flip it up, and they'd given me a loading order on how to load an armored personnel carrier, and it had the ammo, the 50 caliber ammo stacked on the right, and I went, and a lot of things wrong. And I went in and to battalion headquarters, and I said, I don't know who the dumb son of a bitch was that drew up this order, but machine gun loads from the left, and you got ammo stacked on the right. And your bandoliers, you don't need back in the back. You drape them over your bat wings so that you can throw them to whoever needs ammo. Mm-hmm. And I said, your flares, if you're left or right-handed, that's where your flare box goes, because you don't have time to move. You know, mm-hmm. I'm sitting on a tube before, and I just that's what I was. Mm-hmm. You just grab it and fire the flares, whatever. And the guy took the paper from me, and I said, here's how you should be loaded. He took the paper, he said, Lieutenant, I'm the dumb son of a bitch that drew that up. He's a major. And I remember that, and I always thought that was funny. And I remember being at Graves Registration, and my platoon sergeant showing me how to roll a Coke on a block of ice. You can roll it for about 30 seconds, and it's cold, and it doesn't fizz. But I'd forgotten about the body. But I remember later untying it from the rope while the chopper hovered, and nobody went around it. And it was one of those deals where I was the one that had to do it. Mm-hmm. And then I did get a couple of guys to hit me loaded into the mortar track, mm-hmm. and we took it in. But it was shriveled up. It was burned bad. Mm-hmm. That was a strange deal. But some of those things I've just blocked out. Some of the things are funny things. We had to go in to do something, either pick up something or whatever, but my guys had one track that went in. I think they took somebody in. I got a call that I needed to discipline them. And that they had been disrespectful and a lot of stuff. And I asked what happened, and they said they wouldn't let them into the PX because they were dirty. And so we ran over their white rocks, and they did. They did wheelies on the rocks, or just where you flip your track and it just turned in a circle. Because they had their white rocks painted, and they wouldn't let my guys in because they were dirty. And we were dirty. Uh-huh. But that's just...
Now, you mentioned before with the helicopter incident, that in the heat of battle, in the heat of combat, these kinds of things might happen. In those kinds of environments, in the heat of battle for your unit, did you have a hard time controlling your men sometimes, or were they pretty responsive?
Very responsive. They did what they really did work together well. They worked with each other. I had the one guy panic. He had about 45 days left, and it was extremely loud that day. And the fight had lasted a lot longer than they normally did. Mm-hmm. But the guys were basically good guys.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you go ahead and tell us about the mine story?
Yeah, it was a real slow day in the war, and I was a pay officer. And you get to go in, you spend one night, pick up your pay, and the next morning you catch a convoy out, and you drop off and pay your guys, go back in and turn in anyone who wasn't there anymore or anything like that. Spend another night, so those were, two good nights you got to spend in a nice base camp. Mm-hmm. But I was paying, and I was walking, because we're about a quarter mile apart, and just carrying an M60, or not an M16, trying to look like a little snuffy. And I had to go to the bathroom, and I had an entrenching tool, and I took one, wasn't next to the road, it was across the bar ditch, and because that would be where we would pull to do our strong point. And I took one scoop, and I saw metal underneath it. And so I cleaned the top off, and then I cleaned around it. And I called it in and asked if I could blow it in place. And they had to get, clearance, and they kept telling me no, and I kept digging. And they finally called and they went, are you sure? Is this a mine? And I said, well, it's the size of a cake box or a cake pan. And it's got a plate on the top, a plunger in the middle, and it's only got one handle. I think it's a mine. And they sent a tank and a Jeep down. And the tank, we tied onto the handle with a long, long rope. And everybody got down and they pulled it out. It didn't explode. They put it in the back of the Jeep. I would have put it on the tank and took it back to Kontoon. It's in somebody's den now, I guess. I don't know. We had my platoon sergeant was, a scrounger. He'd been in the Army. He knew how to do everything. And since every night we had to bury our trash, our sea ration cans and stuff, he had the idea that we would get a 5-pound shape charge and just blow us a hole, and that could be our latrine and everything else. Mm-hmm. So we ordered the shape charge. And the Army sent you whatever they had, and they had a 25-pound shape charge. And we put it where we wanted our latrine to be, and blew it. And one of the legs actually stuck in the side of the armored personnel carrier. But I was behind the door, which is steel or iron anyway. And it would have swallowed a Jeep. Everybody was afraid to go around the hole, but we never had to worry about digging another hole. But it was a health hazard if you'd fallen into it. It was huge.
That. How did the various, I guess, for lack of a better expression, races get along? Did you mentioned that you have some blacks, mm-hmm. Whites, Hispanics? Were there many Hispanics?
Quite a few. When I first got to Fort Dix, I got my first exposure to, you know, the boys, the hoods, mm-hmm. and the blacks in basic were off the streets of New York. They hung together and they were a virtual, not a gang, but they were, it wasn't us with them. They were just wanted to be by themselves and be the tough guys that they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was broken up though, because like our first sergeant was black and was an outstanding individual, and the Army treated everyone the same, and or I believe they did. Mm-hmm. And I had a great deal of respect for him. He had a voice like a rusty bugle. Mm-hmm. And then my platoon sergeant, or what do you call him, drill sergeant, was black. And he and I got along fine. I was a squad leader. And he was good. In Vietnam, most of the instructors in jungle school and a lot of them in AIT were Puerto Ricans. Mm. And it's a different kind of Hispanic, but... And they had their accents, which we made fun of. You know, the jungle is your friend, and your friend will kill you. And they were good at what they did. We had I don't remember a single racial incident, never in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And we had black classmates in OCS. Leroy Moultrie is one of my favorite classmates or friends. So,
what about drug problems? Of course. There have been allegations that the Army had problems with drugs, mm-hmm. in Vietnam, soldiers doing drugs. Were there any incidents or problems in your unit or the units that were in your company or battalion?
I think most of the drugs were the REMFs that had those, and that's, mm-hmm. you know, that term. Mm-hmm. We had no drugs out in the field. I did get a medic in one time that we were at LZ Joyce, and I went by checking the hoochies, or not hoochies, they're bunkers, mm-hmm. and they were smoking marijuana that he had brought. And so I did not accept him. I sent him back. I think he probably got an Article 15 if he got anything. But that was the only incident of smoking. And you had to have a clear head. You didn't, you know, I wouldn't have, you know, I'd drink when I'd go back in to be pay officer, but I would never drink or anything out in the field, because mm-hmm. you had to be sharp.
And that was something that the soldiers automatically accepted as part of their survival? Was it something you had to really ride herd on? Or was
no,
it was
not at all. Yeah. They didn't want, they wouldn't have done it. Mm-hmm. And if anyone did do it, you know, he'd get sent back, which is kind of bad because the punishment is no punishment at all, really, to be sent back. Mm-hmm. So, and it did go on, I think, in base camps. But I saw it that one time. I saw it one time in the barracks at Fort Dix. But in fact, the first time I'd ever seen marijuana in my life, and a guy was sitting on the john with a joint. But it wasn't the problem that everybody says it is.
Okay. Let's go ahead and turn to a couple of questions about the effects of Vietnam on your life. And I was wondering if you could tell us how was Vietnam important in terms of one of your lifelong experiences, one of your formative experiences? How was it most important?
I don't know. You realize things about yourself, and the ones who went and served, and especially there's a camaraderie or just a feeling that you've survived combat, and you no longer have to question, am I macho enough or whatever, because that's the ultimate test. And there's nothing macho about it. It's just that you did it. You didn't panic. You did your job. And there's a camaraderie. There's a spirit that's born in combat. And I don't have any macho hobbies right now, and don't feel I have to. So,
did Vietnam affect your religious beliefs at all?
No, I've always been fairly religious. I mean, very personally. But as far as, I had two incidents with medics when we pulled back for stand down because we were so beat up. Mm-hmm. We had 4 days to get our equipment back together, and I got a copy of the Army Times, and it listed, there were 167, I think, killed that week. Mm-hmm. And Lieutenant Bob Paulus was one I saw. Now, I thought he died in August, but he was killed in June, I found later. But it affected me, and I actually, all my men were safe, and I laid in a bar ditch and cried for about an hour. I asked the chaplain to give us a service, something about, and to mention Paulus and, you know, about the sacrifices we made. Mm-hmm. And the chaplain preached a Christmas service. This was August.
Wow.
And I didn't respect him. I wouldn't have gone to him for anything. Later, when we got in, when I'd been shot, and I woke up because they cleaned the wound and wrapped me in ace bandages to ship me to Tokyo for operation. We had a chaplain come by, and so this is the second chaplain. And he asked, how long did it take? And I said, well, it took about a half hour to get medevac because until we got gunships in. Mm-hmm. And he said, they got ships all the way up in the mountains? I go, no, padre. And because he'd been asking what he could do, I said, I'll take a Pepsi just to get rid of him.
So the chaplains weren't all that effective or useful?
The two that I met were not at all. They were totally worthless. But that was them as an individual. It has nothing to do with religion. But
how do you feel, or what do you think about your Vietnam service now?
I think that we gave Southeast Asia 10 years to get ready to. Otherwise, I still believe in the domino theory. Mm-hmm. I do. We may have fought it the right way, only because we already had Chinese communists in. We know now, but that was our big fear, was going to war with China. Mm-hmm. And you can't judge it using today's criteria. You've got to be back there with the Cold War going on. Mm-hmm. With Kennedy and Khrushchev and the missile crisis and all that stuff going on. Mm-hmm. So you can't do it like it is today. And we probably didn't do it right, because we didn't go in to win. We went in almost the status quo.
You had mentioned earlier that when you first entered the military, that part of your reluctance or part of your concern was you didn't think we were in it to win. Mm-hmm. And could you elaborate a little bit more on that? What do you think we could have done differently?
Well, you know, I was older than most, and I listened to the news, and you hear the coups and the various generals, and it didn't seem like it was a democracy we were protecting, and I don't believe it was. I believe there are a lot of good people, and I've met a lot of them since then, Bui Xim and some of the others, but and General Khan. But it from the news reports I got, I just didn't feel good about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did like Ho Chi Minh. Mm-hmm. I mean, I respected him and what he had done. Mm-hmm. And we had, in fact, I knew that he had been part of helping the down flyers in World War II get them out. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem, you know, we were more worried that he was a communist. And I believed then, and it's grown, that he was more of a nationalist first and a communist second. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you talk about these kinds of issues with your fellow officers, your fellow lieutenants, or commanders?
Very little. I don't recall.
The political aspects.
We talked about the Arvins and them not fighting, and there was a lot of disgruntled folks because we felt like we were doing their fighting for them. But I didn't realize that if they left, the Viet Cong or whoever could come in and kill their families and would have, and that you know, that's why they stayed, because they took their families with them.
Okay. What did you think about the folks back home protesting, the student activists, the anti-war activists? Did you and your fellow officers talk about that at all?
Some did not like them. Mm-hmm. Later saw films of Jane Fonda, and she's probably the only person that I would not accept. General Ook, you know, quite friendly with, but Jane Fonda, no. Because she was, to me, she was a traitor. And it's one thing to have a belief, and I have nothing against somebody who believed the war was wrong and spoke out about it, that's fine. But you need to separate the warriors from the war. And because those of us who were doing what we considered our duty didn't deserve the treatment some of us got.
How were you treated upon your return?
Well, I was medevac back, so I had a different... my brother-in-law told me that somebody had thrown piss on me, but I don't remember that. There were protesters, Jane Fonda for one, at Travis. I was in a cast from my waist to my neck. There was more just the isolation. You know, you'd be in an airport, and people wouldn't come up to you or talk to you. Really... There's more of an isolation, and that was probably the cruelest thing.
Mm-hmm. What was it like being in Vietnam one moment, and then all of a sudden being back in, as they put it, the world, mm-hmm. being back in the U.S.?
It was weird, but I only had one reaction. I stepped out of my wife's house, her grandmother's house, and I had a white shirt on, and it was night, and I jumped back in real quick, but... I didn't have any trouble adjusting or anything, mm-hmm. not really.
What do you think are the major lessons that we should learn from Vietnam, from that experience?
That if we're going to go to win. I sure don't want people to think that Kosovo is the rule right now, because we haven't won that yet. It's not over. And they're basically back to a stalemate where they were. I think we need to, if we're going to go, we need to be totally committed and not just hope that we can do it with airstrikes and not lose anybody. Mm-hmm. I'm not anti-war, but there needs to be a damn good reason before we do it, and we need to all be committed if we're going to go.
Well, Kosovo is an interesting example to bring up, because of course there were a number of individuals who made parallels to how we were conducting the operations in Kosovo to how we conducted operations in Vietnam, with the incremental increase in air power and the threats of potential ground combat and things of that nature. Do you see for the United States a role in the world in international relations, international events, that would put men into situations like Vietnam again? Do you think that it's appropriate for us to do those kinds of operations? Or?
I think that there will be certain times, like with Iraq, where our economic interests were threatened more so than our sovereignty or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And that was done the right way. Mm-hmm. Kosovo, Somalia, were done the wrong way. You don't start a war small and try to escalate, because that's what we did in Vietnam, and that didn't work. You can't bomb somebody into surrender. You can kill them. You can stop their ability to wage war, but you're not going to bomb them into submission. If you don't kill them, they're just pissed off, and you kill their kids or something. And I think anytime you go to war, you go to war with all you have, everything you've got. And then you can back off, but you don't start it small. That's not right.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, discuss?
I think that's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. This ends the oral history interview with Phil Price.